Okay. Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and I want to thank you all for coming to share an evening with Peter Bagg, our resident cartoonist and I guess comic essayist is one way to put it. What we're going to do tonight is Peter and I are going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes and just kind of go over some basic biographical facts so we can be sure that this is in fact Peter Bagg, since we really don't know him very well except from the stuff he sends us from time to time. And what I'd like to do before we get started is also just let you know a couple other things. We're going to have a happy hour on Tuesday, September 11th, which is a day that will live in infamy, but also probably an inebriation for many of us, at least this anniversary. That's going to be at the Big Hunt, which is on Connecticut Avenue, just south of DuPont Circle. You can check the Reason website and the Reason blog, Hit and Run, for more information about that. I also want to make sure that you know that there are three magazines, both the August-September issue, which features Peter's wonderful cover story essay about owning a bazooka and the inalienable rights of that, as well as our latest issue, our October issue, which has just come out and will be on newsstands very shortly. Make sure you see that. We also have Matt Klokol, who runs a great comic book store up in Tenleytown called Phantom Comics. He's right outside the elevator, and he's selling some of Peter's collected works. Please take a look at that and see if there's something there you'd like to purchase. And then before we get into the main program, I also want to just thank John LaBohm, who is the program manager at Reason, for all of the work he did in putting logistics together. But what we're going to talk about now is I want to introduce the man of the hour, the man of the evening, Peter Bagg. So please join me in welcoming Peter. Peter, let's please tell us, I feel like I'm on with my line or something, but give us a very quick thumbnail bio of who you are. Where were you born, where were you raised, and where do you live now?
All right. Well, I'm a cartoonist, which you've already established, and I was born in the suburbs of New York City, lived in New York the first 25, 26 or so years of my life, and but since 84 I've been in Seattle.
Why did you move to Seattle? In 84, so you were pre-grunge, pre-River's Edge.
Yeah. Although, well, pre, when I see those movies, they remind me so much of my own upbringing. In the whole grunge scene, I couldn't believe it took off and became a look or a style, because when I was in high school, we wore flat underwear and the plaid shirts, just because we wanted to stay out in the woods all night and get stoned because there's nothing else to do, but and stay warm.
Right.
So, and the music we listened to back then, too, was so much like what became called grunge. So I was flabbergasted at this, when that phenomenon hit, that it was considered something new. But,
So why did you
move to Seattle? Well, again, I want to back up a little bit. Cartoonists, for the most part, especially, they, even more, like now a lot of people do this. Like the whole, like Reason magazine is practically a virtual magazine where people, they contribute.
We like to say we're virtually a magazine.
And it's the same, well, with cartoonists, it's almost always been that way. It's, you might want to establish yourself, live in somewhere like New York, that's where the publishing is, but once, after a while, once you've established yourself, you can live anywhere, and that's been true with cartoonists forever. So, with just about every cartoonist I know, when you ask them why, well, especially if it's male, if you ask them why do you live where you live, it's always because of a wife or girlfriend, and you just follow her, you know. She gets a job somewhere, she goes to school somewhere, and that's always, that like 99% of the time, that's the answer to the question. And so that's the same with me. It's actually an interesting story. My wife and I, we met in art school in New York City in the late 70s. You know, lived in the city during the punk days, the punk new wave days, which was great, and we loved it. We used to think we'd never, ever want to live anywhere else. And by the time I was 23, I couldn't wait to get out of New York. Already outgrown it, and but we didn't know where to move. You know, we both lived in New York all our lives. How we wound up going to Seattle was because I'll try not to get too convoluted, but my wife's sister is married to a football player, now a football coach, and so right out of college, she got drafted.
Not O.J. Simpson.
No.
I wish.
Right, any names so the person?
Yeah, his name
is it a 70s
No. His name is Mike Tice, and for a while he was the head coach of the Vikings. But he played as a football player. He played like 14 years, had a long career. And so he got drafted by the Seahawks. They loved it out there. We would go out and visit it. We loved it too. And then the only thing they didn't like about Seattle was that there was no New York-style deli. So my wife is a cook, and she always closes in the food business. So we moved out there, and her sister started a New York-style deli out in Seattle, which she had for like 8 years.
And you you have a daughter as well?
Yes.
How old is she?
She's just turned 17, so yeah, we're already facing the emptiness syndrome. Mm-hmm. But yeah, whenever she's like not home, you know, she goes hanging out with her friends, and my wife and I just stare at each other. We can't remember how we, what we did before we had a kid. It's like how we, you know, because our lives like totally is built around.
Does that how does that factor into your work at all?
Having a daughter?
Yeah, or your family.
Well, all of it does to some degree. Although, like, what I like to do, like, my most famous comic book character is a character named Buddy Bradley. And it wasn't intentional at first, but as time went by, he's on the cover. He's on. That's the fanciful, of course, that cover, that A cover. He doesn't actually. Well, actually, later he did. Later did buy a monster truck, but it was a sickly one.
Well, finish the how your family.
Well, the thing is with Buddy Bradley, he's always. It wound up coming obvious to me that he was always me 10 years ago. You know, and the reason for that is I like that distance so I can look back on it objectively. Because, you know, when you're right in the middle of something, when you're going through something, it's hard to laugh at it, you know. And so with 8, that when I started that comic book, it was totally based on Buddy Bradley. And at the time I did the comic, I started the comic, I was like in my early 30s, already married, about to become a father, owned a house. And that whole, everything that signifies your youth, you know, renting, going through job after job, you know, always broke, all of those things. So all of a sudden, that was completely in my past. And because it was something in my past, I could encapsulate it. I could think about all of it as stories. And plus, all of a sudden, it was hilarious. When you're broke, it's not hilarious. But then later on.
Let's talk a little bit more about Hate was one of the defining alternative comics of the 1990s. And it was heavily associated, partly because you were in Seattle, with grunge or with like a whole new West Coast scene. Talk a little bit about what was Hate? Where did it come from?
Well, what you just talked about was all very much a fluke. And to some degree, I benefited from it. But even though I put it in the present, even though this character that I had, Buddy Bradley, I had him living in Seattle simply because I lived there. I placed him in Seattle. But then Seattle was just another city, which is kind of what I like. It's like a Springfield on The Simpsons only. But I did want it to make it a real city. But when you hear the name Seattle, people didn't other than rain, they didn't think anything specific about it. And but other than that, it was all, like, everything he was doing was based on me, and me and my friends, and me and my relationships going back over the last 10, 15 previous years. But then it was right after that Nirvana suddenly became really big, and then there was, all of a sudden, Seattle was just crawling with tourists. Not tourists and journalists, especially German journalists. You couldn't go into any pub without tripping over a drunk journalist, declaring Seattle dead. But then because of that, it helped to attract a lot of attention to the comic because they were able to link it. That was like a perpetual sidebar. People would come to write about Nirvana, but then the journalist he figured he'd get a twofer, so he'd write about the grunge scene, and then the magazine would be a sidebar about my comic book.
So what did they write about?
Oh, pretty much what I was just talking about. And they would usually, the journalists would get it. Usually it would be somebody who was familiar with the comic and liked the comic. But for the average person, though, a lot of people could not, especially younger people, they couldn't help but think that that they were putting the cart before the horse and that I was doing this to simply take advantage of this whole grunge thing. That this came afterwards, or some afterthoughts, and that I was just simply trying to exploit the whole thing, which wasn't true.
Although, if you could, you would, right? You're, as a capital, right. You're a fan of it.
Right. And I should say, too, it's like Haig was selling a certain amount, and then when all this brunch phenomenon happened, you'd think the sales would have gone through the roof, but it didn't. The sales were still really good. But still, there were a lot of people. Oh, there were a lot of people in their 20s at the time who started. It was almost like a stereotypical thing for a Gen X slacker to do is, don't pigeonhole me, man. You know, it's like you knew you were talking to a slacker when you would have a fit if you called them a slacker or a Gen X. So they resented all those terms. They hated somebody trying to market anything to them. You know, God forbid somebody would try to figure out what I like and then create products for me that I would like. How dare they?
talk a little bit about Neat Stuff and some of your other earlier things.
All right, well, Neat Stuff was a comic I did before Haig, and it was basically a one-man anthology. And at the time I moved to Seattle, I still was making very little money. And I hurt myself professionally by leaving New York to Seattle because I wasn't quite established yet. So while I was in Seattle, I was just basically for the next 4 or 5 years living off of my wife with her business. And I mean, I made some money, but very little. So I was fortunate enough to meet my main comic book publishers. It's a company called Fantagraphics. And fortunately for me, they're
based in Seattle.
Yes, when I met them, they were based in the New York area, and I was still in the New York area. Then when I moved to Seattle, they moved to L.A. But over the intervening 5 years, I loved Seattle, and they really hated Los Angeles. So they wound up following me up to Seattle, where they've been ever since. But when they met me, I showed them samples of my work, and it was like a dream come true to a large degree, other than no money. But I couldn't believe that they agreed to give me my own title, where I could do whatever I wanted. So that's pretty much what each step was. It gave me a forum to grow and develop and figure out what I wanted to do. So it had a whole different cartoon character.
I realize we're kind of going backwards and forwards here. Why did you become a cartoonist, and who are your big influences?
Yeah, well, I was a terrible student, and always was, and I had no options. And the one thing that I had, one of the very few things I had any inclination towards was cartooning. But again, I just had no work ethic as a kid. I was a really pathetic teenager, and so the cartoon was always dabbled. And I can't totally blame everybody for this. I should have follow my passion, as the saying goes, but I'd never, not just my parents, but every teacher I ever had, every art teacher I ever had, I'd never met anybody, I'd never met an adult back then, I'm talking about the 70s, who encouraged me to become a cartoonist. Compared to now, back then, cartooning was an extremely disreputable occupation. Our teachers would say, you'll make no money, you'll have no friends, and it isn't even art. It's not even art. Nobody will like you. And and my parents, too. Whenever I'd tell anybody, I'd like to do comics, they'd go, great, go into advertising. You know, they immediately would be like, take my body and steer me in another direction. And it was the same. The art school I went to, which is the School of Visual Arts, amazingly was started by cartoonists right after World War II. It was started by Bernd Hogarth and the very first, and long-time teachers there. The best teachers were this Harvey Kurtzman, who started Mad Magazine, Will Eisner, who did The Spirit in the 40s, and their young teacher was Art Spiegelman, who did War Magazine and did the comic Mouse. So here they had this phenomenal faculty of teachers, but still in all the other classes, when I was a freshman, they made us take, at art school, you had to take everything. They insisted you have a photography class and you have a painting class. You sample everything, photography.
How was the math class there?
No, it was all, you had to take one of all the fun stuff. they didn't have any math class. They actually, in order to give a degree, they had an English class. They had a literature class, which was a total joke. We just had a guy that sat there and would give us a short story to read, and then he would insist that absolutely everything was a phallic symbol. Even if it was random. Even if it was random, it was a phallic symbol. So
and
he collected a paycheck for that.
So who were your big idols?
Well, as a little kid, it was Charles M. Schulz especially, but I liked almost anything that was funny that was in the daily papers. Beetle Bailey, Dennis the Menace, I liked not all the funny stuff, but, especially when I was a kid, anything that was funny, or just looked funny, I loved. There was a comic strip called Tiger, I don't know if anybody remembers that, by Blake. loved that. It wasn't a particularly funny strip, but I loved his art. And but then as the 70s went on, some of the newer, more popular comic strips, I really hated. Doonesbury, I absolutely loathe. And it was really for the art. It, like, even as I got older, it was like, oh, this is all so stupid. but the art was just, it was so artless. There was just, and I didn't mind simple. I liked simple, but it was just so hard to look at.
Are you a big fan of Do It Every Time?
Or Do It Every Time. Oh, Bill Paxton. Yeah, when I was a kid, yeah, sure. Well, not a big fan, but I liked it.
You suffered for it. Well, listen. Right. So who were you besides Schultz? Who else?
Well, in Mad, all the people in Mad magazine I loved. But then when I was in art school, the real light bulb that went off in my head was I came across an underground comic by Robert Crumb in a record store. And I'd seen Crumb's artwork on covers of records and on t-shirts, you know, Keep on Truckin'. And I loved his art style, but I had never seen one of his solo comic books. So here was this, I always loved the format of comic books, I just didn't always necessarily like what was in them. I was never a big superhero fan. And like when I was a kid, occasionally I'd pick up like a Harvey comic or an Archie comic. But, you know, it's kid stuff and it's really light and the artist is just hacking it out. And there's a Twinkie ad on every other page. You know, so because I'd never seen it, it never occurred to me that you could still take that fantastic format and fill it with cartoon drawings, but you can have complete control from cover to cover. So here was Robert Crumb, like he drew the front cover, he drew and wrote everything from cover to cover. There were no ads in it. And he obviously was going nuts. It helped, of course, that he was phenomenally talented. But when I saw that, I thought, this is exactly what I want to do. Exactly what I wanted to do. So I think I stuck out one more semester of art school and dropped out and never looked back. So I was like about 20 when that happened.
Would you, like Robert Crumb, retire to France?
No. I doubt it though. I've never been to. I can't pretend France because I've never been there. Who knows if I go there, I might love
it.
I like Spain. I considered retiring to Spain, but then my Spanish friends would say, "No, you'd wind up hating it here." I said, "Why?" And they're like, "Because we're always late and nothing works and the ATMs are always broken." And I said, "Well, I can get used to that." They go, "No, you're an American. Americans always think they want to leave here and they'll love it, and then all they do is complain about busted ATMs."
Let's talk about a couple of your DC Marvel type stuff, and then we'll talk about Reason and your political, your politics, and your work for Reason. So, Apocalypse Nerd is a. Tell us a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about the megalomaniacal Spider-Man and other things you've done for kind of mainstream comic books.
Well, all through the 90s, I completely devoted myself to this comic book, Pete. You know, it's like I finally hit on Pater, so to speak. But then after 10 years of that, a lot of other opportunities came up, and I wanted to take advantage of. So, including doing Marvel. Back when Marvel was on the ropes, pretty much, and they were willing to take chances, just throw crap at the wall and see what would stick. And one of those pieces of crap is that Spider-Man, where this editor called me up and just said, "How'd you like to do a one-shot Spider-Man, and you could do whatever you want?" You know, within reason, you know, I couldn't, no swear words, but I was like, sure, why not? You know, it paid great. Marvel has a great flat page rate, so, and it also tied that it was going to come out in time for the movie. So that was another thing, too, is they said, you know, we know that with this Spider-Man movie coming out, the first one, anything with Spider-Man written on it is going to sell great. So they were just flooding the market, like making sure that the comic shops were have Spider-Man stuff and knowing that people would buy it. So, and that thing, that sold 50,000 copies, and that was the worst-selling Spider-Man comic book ever. But it was my best-selling comic book ever. And basically what I did in that story was, I don't know if many people here are familiar with, who know who Steven Ditko is? And
Steve Ditko is the creator of Spider-Man. And also, in this crowd, he's also a hardcore objectivist.
Yes, a little too. Well, they're always a little too. Spider-Man, you know, to be fair, he had two creators. It was the writing, for the most part, was Stan Lee, who was the editor, and the artist was Ditko. But Ditko, you know, he doesn't get nearly as much credit as he deserves. But anyhow, what I did with the character was, the story arc was Spider-Man was doing his thing, being Spider-Man, but he started to second-guess himself, you know, getting beat up for no money. So then I had him. I wasn't explicit about it, but what in my mind, what I had him do is I had him turn into Stan Lee. He turned into a real huckster who did everything he could to make money off of the Spider-Man brand. He, like, marketed himself. So he just all of a sudden, instead of the Daily Planet, whatever newspaper works for,
Daily Bugle,
all of a sudden it's like just the Spider-Man building, you know, and James Jonah Jameson is his gopher. But then, like, as you follow the story more, then he experiences another crisis, and then at the very end of the story, he's basically Ditko. I had him turn into Steve Ditko. And again, like, I wrote it so that you didn't have to know all the stuff for the story to work, but Ditko is a very strange character where he's had the same little office in Midtown Manhattan since the 1960s, and doesn't make much money. He's very picky about what he says. You'd think he'd be calling up whatever studio put out the Spider-Man movies and Marvel themselves and demanding a piece of the action. He doesn't. He doesn't care. He doesn't worry about that stuff. I'm very good friends with a cartoonist named Dan Klaus who wrote the comics that got turned into the movie Ghost World and Art School Confidential. And if you're familiar with his work, you can see he's very inspired by Ditko. And so when he was an art student, like he was going to art school the same time I was, and somebody said, you know, if you open up the Yellow Pages, in the Yellow Pages you can find it's a Stephen Ditko cartoonist, and it has his phone number and address. So he was like, oh, that's one of his heroes. So he called up Stephen Ditko, and he wouldn't answer the phone. So he says, I'm just going to go there. Yeah, what a businessman. So he just went there, and like the address was in the phone book, and he knocked on the door, and he was just this really skinny, baby-faced art student, and this guy, this older guy, just opens up and goes, yeah. And he goes, Steve Ditko, you don't know me. My name's Dan Klaus. I'm an art student. I just want to tell you that growing up, you're like my hero.
Well, let's talk about your recent work and your politics, and then we'll open it up to some audience Q&A. But you, we were talking about this earlier. Your first illustration for Reason was either in 2000 or 2001, and I couldn't find a scan of it. But it was a fake cover for what was it, like Embittered Comic Artist?
Yes.
Or something. Brian Doherty, a senior editor now at the magazine, wrote an essay about the persistence of the superhero, even though everybody's embarrassed by superhero comics and liking superheroes and whatnot. And we had Peter, who had also worked at Suck, which Brian, at website, suck.com, which Peter, Brian, and I had all worked at. But then you started doing a monthly column for us. It was a one-page, and then he started doing four-page comic essays, which continue, and he does 3 to 4 a year. And he's done a bunch of covers for us. Here are some covers. I'll let you all in on a secret that what happens when we can't find art for something, we turn to Peter and ask him to come up with something. So you can see the range of things he did. The Reason 1.03, which was January 2003, we had a cover story about stupid juries, so we went to Peter for that. It would be May of 2002. We had a story about intellectual property as a way that big content companies were squaring off against computer makers about digital rights management and other things. And then I think that was January of 2006, debate about radical human enhancement, which Ron Miller was the great player in, and Peter did that. Over the years, over the past 6 or 7 years or so, Peter has done dozens of pieces, which are all available online now at Reason.com. If you go to, do a search for Peter Bagg, covering a wide range of topics, going from him declaiming the perennial attempt to create a monorail in Seattle, to confessions of a lazy anti-warrior, to declaiming art for art's sake, or art for artist's sake. Yes, that's what you were most
excited about. Just what Pat passes for with fine art or real art.
Right. So,
and just me pointing out how it's just another genre. It's another genre for people with specific tastes, except that they don't see it that way. You know, they're completely convinced that theirs is the only art, and everything like comics. That comics are the only big art. So back up a little bit too. When I was in art school, when I was in art school, that 1.5 years, I had a drawing teacher, and I was And I was a surprised pupil to Stanley. He was a fine artist, and he drew very realistically, but of all the kids in this particular class...
Is this the guy who did the turtle on the matchbook cover?
Yes, that's who he was. And but he was a fine artist, and we'd always talk a lot, but just about drawing. You know, it was all life drawing and drawing realistically. And I don't know how it came up, but one day I was standing in the hallway talking to him, and I told him. That was going to be my dream. Was the next thing, you should try to get into this gallery or try to pursue this or that. And I said, well, I want to be a comic book artist. And he said, you're kidding, right? I said, no, I'm serious. And on that, he turned on his heels and walked away and never talked to me again.
And oddly, no matter what you drew, he would never see a phallic symbol.
That wasn't his job. He wasn't a literary.
Here is Peter's latest offering for us. An Extreme Defense of the Second Amendment. And copies of this are outside if you haven't seen it yet.
And I didn't want to make the facial expression. I thought that facial expression didn't match the story, but Nick and the art director Barb, they just simply thought it would be funny.
Yeah.
I wanted to be more like, yeah.
We should talk about Barb since she isn't here.
So it's Nick Donover.
No, but let's talk about your politics. How do you define yourself politically?
A libertarian.
Okay. What does that mean for you? And then how do you come up with, what are the issues that exercise you, and how do you come up with ideas for reason?
I probably got some of it from my dad, he was a gold hoarder Republican, but also he always gladly and unabashedly voted for the old Northeast establishment Republicans, like Rockefeller, Javits. He loved those guys just fine, but hated Democrats passionately, but he ran into a wall with the Republicans when they started winning, when Reagan brought in the religious right. That drove my dad crazy. We were Catholics, but very lazy Catholics. You know, like, once all of us kids said we don't want to go to church anymore because we're missing Wonderama, he went, okay. He didn't care. So, his shorthand for evangelicals is cavemen. Design is in bed with those cavemen from Louisiana. But when I would ask him why, because I was very sympathetic to all the things that people were protesting about work. And he was to some degree, but you know, and you'd think that he'd be a Democrat for those reasons, but he would explain to me why he voted Republican. And it had everything to do with what is the role of government. Just very generic stuff like that. And he was in the military, he was in the Air National Guard, and he saw firsthand how things just get out of control if you let it, and everybody just squanders money. So I think that, I guess maybe that was the germ. At a very young age, I was able to think two ways. Because he didn't, when I would say, but don't you care about, you know, people marching in the street for civil rights and stuff like that? And he wasn't against it. He never sit there on the TV saying, you know, the black shouldn't have equal rights. Women's lib, bah. He never, as Archie, he had Archie Bunker's temperament, but he would never, you know, he was somewhat sympathetic to all of that stuff. But he gave me another perspective, you know, and he never, that's just typical of his kids. He never told us, that civil rights stuff is bunk. I guess you would say my dad was sort of a libertarian and didn't know it. But I always had somewhat that perspective, and especially after I moved to New York City and was going to art school, that became more pronounced, because when people would talk about rights, like everybody, the artist types are obsessed with the First Amendment. The First Amendment is like so holy. And don't you dare step on my right to express myself. But then you come to the Second Amendment, and all of a sudden the brakes are on. It's like, that doesn't count for anything. I'm like, how do you figure that one means everything, and the very next amendment means absolutely nothing? It doesn't mean nothing. You're completely against it. It's like, stop screaming and hollering about the First Amendment if you don't even believe in the Second one. You obviously don't believe in the Constitution. that, you know, once you can't get past the first one. And that's what made me all of a sudden, like somebody told me what a libertarian was. Somebody just, I can't even remember who it was, but they told me what the definition was. And I was like, yeah, that sounds good.
Can you tell us what that definition was?
Believing in the Constitution. Well, it's just like as little freedom, as little government interference as possible. And one thing that drives me crazy is when people, and you hear this all the time, is that a libertarian is anti-government. You know, if I believed in no government, I would describe myself as an anarchist. And I've known plenty of anarchists. And it's funny how so many people will say, libertarians drive me crazy, and then I'll say why, and they start spouting a bunch of crap. But anarchists drive me crazy because they come from all over the place too. Some of them are like, they're like communists. They're total communists except no government. I'm like, how can you have this perfect communist world with no? And they would tell. I remember I worked with this guy for years. I was a clerk at Barnes and Noble, and I worked with this guy who was a very left leaning anarchist, and we would have these most ridiculous circular arguments, and he would tell me how he goes, he didn't believe in money, and I go, why no money? You know, but of course, money, you need a government to print the money that we'd all agree on. And he said, no, you just barter everything. And I said, well, all right, well, let's say you're a poet and you want to eat an orange, but you live in New York. How are you going to get that orange? So you just barter with the grocery store guy. Well, what if he doesn't want a poem? You know? What if he doesn't want 1,000 poems? And also then, what is the grocery going to do? Barter with the truck driver? And the truck driver has to barter with the people who are picking the fruit in Florida? I said, that sounds like such a nightmare. How about let's have money? But, I'm pretty much left-leaning, you know, amongst libertarians.
What does that mean?
Well, here's the simplest way to put it. You know how, and this is true most of all libertarians who bother to vote, you know how it's always like, geez, I want to vote for the libertarian guy, but amongst the two people who are going to win, the Republican and the Democrat, one of them might win, and it depends, like with presidents, it's like my state could go either way, and you know I might want to throw my weight for the lesser of the two evils. And with me, that always winds up being a Democrat. It's not made up ahead of time, but I found that for as long as I've been voting, I wind up voting for the Democrat, and it has everything to do with for as long as, well, the first Republican I had a chance to vote for when I turned 18, and I listened to the presidential debates, and it was between Carter and Ford. And I saw President Ford say that Portland isn't under the control of Russia. And I was like, I can't believe he's a plain old moron. And, you know, I might not agree in principle to hardly much of what Carter has to say, but, you know, at least he's not a truly moron. I mean, I know he's backed up a lot since then, but, like the next day, Ford was like, no, I didn't mean that, but he still said it, and that was a dumb thing to say. Then I was just 18, and I was like, duh. And after that, it was Reagan, and just, well, you know, for example, I'm pro-choice, things like that. And it's just, and that tends to be a deal-breaker. And the other thing, too, with Republicans is they say they're small government, but from my experience, I've seen they're not. You know, they're better about, like, they don't raise taxes as much or as eagerly as Democrats do, but they spend just as freely, you know. I don't know. I mean, I hate them both, but but I just find when it's push comes to shove, it's like I couldn't stand Kerry, but I think I voted for him. And I mean, I can't stand it when people would tell me, "How can you vote for Kerry? He believes love the body." Oh, I know. But his name isn't George W. Bush. I voted for Dukakis just because his name wasn't George Bush.
Well, on that note, let's open it up to the audience.
I was going to say, Kerry!
I think Neil Bush RSVP. So would somebody raise your hand and ask a question? Yes, thank you.
Oh, go ahead. Maybe.
What's going on with Paco's Nerd?
Is that Dennis?
Yes. I could ask you this online, but
Paco's Nerd is all done. It was up before. That's a 6-issue miniseries I did for a different publisher called Dark Horse. And I went with Dark Horse largely because it's an independent publishing company, but the guy that owns Dark Horse, his name is Mike Richardson, has a phenomenal track record for getting his comics and miniseries that he publishes into movies. And I was hoping this could turn into a movie. Of course, the story wound up taking like such a dark turn that it would have never...
Could you explain for...
Okay, Apocalypse Nerd is... What it's about is it takes place in the Northwest where I live, and... it's about this computer nerd and an old friend of his, you know, like an old high school friend. They're a little bit different. The old high school friend's kind of a pot dealer, but they're just two guys that know each other forever. They go on a camping trip, and while they're away on this camping trip, way up in the far north Cascades, North Korea dropped a nuclear bomb on Seattle. So not only is their hometown destroyed, but like at least temporarily society is like all, it's falling apart. And when they try, when they make a vain attempt to get back to what's left of civilization, they just see everybody going nuts. So they try to stay in the woods. It's basically like it's like a computer geek who's trying to be a survivalist, and it's impossible, you know. And he's just miserable. He cries a lot, you know. And it was very much me thinking of me in that situation. And I figured I'd do a lot of crying too. But of course, I'm laughing about it. But it winds the story. It's 6 issues. The last 2 issues are going to be out in the next 2 months.
Oh, cool.
Dark Horse kind of messed up, but they should have been in print in time for this little jaunt I'm on. But it takes an incredibly, really, I don't want to give it away, but it takes a really dark turn.
I'm looking forward to it. In terms of a movie, do you see it as like a Shaun of the Dead style movie, like that sort of dark?
No, because Shaun of the Dead is a strict satire. Yeah. And this isn't satirizing anything. It's kind of hard to compare it to anything. And it's easy. You could easily see it being a vehicle for a comic actor. And there's a famous comic actor who read the first 3 issues and wanted to do it, and then he read the 4th issue, and I can tell he's starting to change his mind, and when he sees the 4th and 5th, 5th and 6th issue, there's no way he's going to make this movie. Unless, if somebody says, well, let's have it, you know, he winds up making it back to Seattle, and it was all a dream, and it ends in a double wedding, then... which, of course, I'll go along.
That comic actor is R.J. Simpson.
Yes.
Another question. Please, yeah, Bob.
What's your opinion of other cartoons that are sometimes called libertarian, like South Park or Dilbert?
Well, I think the two guys that do South Park are really talented, and I agree with their political views for the most part. I can't watch that show. I hate the way it looks, and the voice of it. I can't listen to it, and I can't watch it. It's all aesthetics. And that's my problem with the show. I cannot watch that show. I can't stomach it. And just art-wise, it's just the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And visually and audibly. It's, to me, it's an abomination, even though I love where they're coming from. I wish I did love it. You know, and they've been involved in other things, and they've done other things that I like. And when I read interviews with them, like in Reason, it's like I agree with just about everything they say, but I just can't, for artistic reasons, I can't watch that show. And I don't know what other cartoonists call themselves libertarian. I get so much grief within the comic book world because it's overwhelmingly left wing, and if people are really
why do you think that is?
Because there are
like Robert Crumb. I mean, I'm yes. sure a number of you have seen the Crumb documentary, but Crumb is left wing. Everybody
right.
is left wing,
and then because of that, they all call me right wing. They always, especially behind my back, they don't all beat that right winger. And when I talk to them, I go, "Do right wingers believe in legalizing drugs and prostitution?" And they're like, "I don't care. You're one or the other. We've decided as a group that you're a right winger." So yeah, it's maddening. But actually, when I do sit down and I'm talking to one, it's so annoying. It's like like Robert Crumb. The last time I saw it, I spent a lot of time with him. I talked about where I was coming from. He seemed to understand it, but of course, as soon as he's with somebody else, he's going to peep with a right winger. You know.
Yes.
I have an older guy that influenced my thinking when I was a young person was Al Capp.
Right.
Are you?
Yeah, I loved Al Capp. Yeah, I thought he was brilliant. His work is very intense because he was a very intense person. He was extremely left-wing. know, very New Deal Democrat, you know, grew up like this, you know, with intellectual, very liberal, left-wing Jewish immigrant parents. And also, he himself, this is his whole story. In case anybody doesn't know what Alcat did, Little Abner, his whole life story is very tortured. Like when he was young, I think it was even a teenager, he got run over by a streetcar. Like Bugs Bunny style. But yeah, he was he had a fake leg, and he was painfully self-conscious of it. And he wasn't a very pretty man to begin with, but not that he was a beast or anything, but with the fake leg and everything, he had this very horrible self-image, coupled with a huge ego. You know, it's just nitroglycerin, you know? and something happened, I mean, I'm sure it happened to a lot of people of his age, but he always was, it's funny, like, his work was very satirical, and he did a great job of pretty much going after everybody, but his main targets were the rich and more profiteers, but then in, like, in the 60s, he lived in Boston, then in the 60s, one day, this is his story, I'm quoting him, he said he was walking down the street, and he saw a bunch, you know, these young hooligans hanging out on these stoops. And all around them was garbage, just littering garbage all around them. And he walked to his studio one day, and there was all this garbage around him. And he's going, I hope those guys pick up all their garbage. And then he walked back, and the garbage was still there. And so it was like, kids these days. And all of a sudden, from that point on, according to him, he became a right-winger. And so his targets kind of switched. Not totally. He still kind of made fun of everybody to his credit, but he suddenly became, and he turned into a cartoon, ironically, a cartoon right-winger, where what he loved to do is he would never pass up an invitation to speak like at Berkeley. And of course they loved having him, but it would just be a shouting match. It was like a prelude to talk TV talk to like Morton Downey, where he's like, you stupid kids, and they'd be like, and he was like, he was like a professional hippie baiter, you know, and he was great at it. Like I was like, as a kid, I was sympathetic to the hippies, and like I like rock and roll and Free Love sounded good and all this stuff, but I'd read his take on the hippies and it was always hilarious.
He had the great showdown with John at Yoko.
Yeah, and,
right.
Montreal. And again, and so many young friends of mine who don't know Lil Abner, that's their first, that's their introduction to Al Capp, is where in the movie he goes on this somewhat sexist, racist tirade against Johnny Yoko. You can tell that all he was trying to do was, he could just tell, he looks at John Lennon and he sees himself. He goes, you know, you think you're peace and love, you're not kidding me, I could tell that you're the type of guy that is very quick to punch somebody's lights out. Which he was. John Lennon was a very violent man by nature. That's part of why he was so, peace and love, he was talking to himself more than anybody else. Trying to cure himself from being like a wife beater. And, you know, but he was trying to provoke Lennon, he was trying to get the Liverpool out of him. And so what he kept doing was he kept insulting his wife, so he made a lot of sexist, not a lot, but he made a few little sexist, racist digs. And it didn't, Lennon was getting mad, but he didn't fall for it. You could tell he wanted to beat the living crap out of him, but he didn't. Well, if there was 1,000 TV cameras around, you know, the whole gig would have been blown if he did, you know. So out of that, blood, like, it didn't work, you know. Could have hit him with my wooden leg. But it felt terrible because some people, you know, it's like, Al Capp is like, he's a phenomenal artist. He was such a great cartoonist. And it drives me crazy that all people, and they won't read his comics because, he's the guy that, you know, called Yoko Ono ugly, you know.
Yeah, Lil Abner is a tremendous script, which was in thousands of papers.
Right, and it was a musical.
Yeah.
But yeah, as he got older, I think he died in the late 70s, he just got so wretched. He became such a wretched human being.
Well, you have that to look forward to.
Yeah, there you go.
Bradley in the back.
Hey, do you have an opinion on the Berkeley arrested Muslim cartoon controversy?
Nah. I mean, people always ask me about that. You know, the Muslim stuff. Well, it's basically, yeah, of course I believe he should write whatever he wants to. The same with the Danish cartoons with, where they drew Muhammad. But of course I think they should be allowed to draw that.
But you do believe there is no God but Allah.
Why no? But, that's my take on it.
So then what happened? I'm
reluctant. Bert Brecht is one of his cartoons. I don't like him. I don't like the way he draws. He's he draws a little bit better than Doonesbury. He's always seemed like a Doonesbury wannabe. So for that reason alone, if it wants to be Doonesbury, he immediately hates. So it's like, so when Muslims complain about him, I'm like, go Muslims.
With the blue striped shirt.
Yeah. What's the story with Finley Circus? Are you
That's another strip of the county.
And then the other kind of, have you seen the kind of the H.P. Lovecraft renditions of Family Circus?
No, I haven't. Is that where they take? Yeah.
Yeah, they take the quotes out of H.P. Lovecraft. And
no, I haven't seen that. But for ages, like at San Diego. We don't do this yet, the comic, San Diego Comic Convention. We don't do this anymore because we're matured and we're not funny anymore. But what we used to always do was even comics we love, like Peanuts, me and my cartoonist friends, we would take Peanuts and erase all the word balloons and write our own. And it was always everything. And the same with, of course, Family Circus, you can't resist. You just can't. We would go nuts. And it was, you know, and the punchline was always about anal rape. We found the funniest comic. There was a comic that ran in Catholic publications, like for Catholic newsletters, and it was all about a monk. It was like this little monk. And somebody found this book. I'd never seen it before, but somebody found this book. It was like done in the 50s and 60s, and it had a very dated style. But it was all gag panels about this little monk. You know, it's like there would be a picture of him, like walking along, and I can't remember what the original caption was. But he's like, you know, he has like this big monk book. So we erased all the original gags, and you can just imagine. So of course, like the panel was like the gags. There was like a little boy inside. We went nuts with that one. That was really ripe. But like I said, we've all matured and we don't do that anymore.
David?
You mentioned that you were influenced by funny comic strips that you liked. What about political cartoonists? Did you have any attraction?
There was somewhere like the Bargain, but yeah.
You got a little curve block? Because
it labels everything? Right. It depends. Like in the... You know, like when I was 11, 12, I was very sympathetic to like what was then the left-wing cause, as far as I understood it, as an 11 or 12-year-old. So there were certain cartoonists, political cartoonists, where whenever I come across their work or see their work, you know, I'd be like, right on. But that's my problem with editorial cartooning. It's just the format of it, and you know, every now and then. You know, somebody will nail something like in a way that's unbelievable. But
Statue of Liberty is crying.
Yes.
You gotta love that.
Well, actually, it does. actually, Seattle has an unprecedented smithy of prejudice, but there's and he's pretty much left leaning. But there's a cartoonist named David Horsey in Seattle, and I like his stuff. But largely, again, it's aesthetics. I like he's a very good artist, but he also has his own style, an awful lot of. Editorial cartoonists, they all seem to draw in this most identical style, this Pat Olden style. It's like, how is it that all of a sudden you guys all draw exactly the same? You all have the same exact style. So that's hard, as another artist, it's hard for me to be totally objective, because when I immediately think of like this very generic newspaper editorial cartoonist style, you know?
Jesse?
And Maria's been an awesome stuff. You've done comic book journalism. Reported scripts. When did you start doing that? And had anyone done that before you? Who were you drawing on as inspirations?
Well, there were a few rare examples of it, and I think the first person that dabbled with it was Harvey Kurtzman, who started Mad Magazine in the early 60s. He had a very low budget, but he started this magazine called Help. I don't know if anybody remembers it. It was like from 60 to 65. It was published by Warren, you know, the creepy and eerie guy. And he, again, on a very low budget, he was probably able to pull it off just because he had, Harvey Kurtzman is very much a cartoonist. We all worship him. And so even back then, if he asked a friend of his to do something, they'd always work for less than normally they get paid, just work with him. So he did a few attempts at something similar to our format that we have with Reason, where he would send somebody to cover something, but it was all, it didn't have a solid story thread. it was like separate. For example, he is very good. His best friend is Jack Davis, the Mad artist, the famous Mad illustrator. And Jack Davis is a baseball fanatic, so he just sent him to Shea Stadium, and he got him a press pass. So a couple of press passes, I guess he went a couple of times, and he just did a bunch of beautiful drawings, all about the Mets, and he made fun of the way journalists act around. You know, some of it was fairly astute, but it was very fanish. You know, it didn't dig very deep. And then he did the funniest thing with Robert Crumb. Robert Crumb was just starting out, and he was broke, and he was desperate to get published, and he was desperate to work for Harvey Kurtzman. So Harvey Kurtzman says, "Do you want to try this, some kind of little cartoon journalism?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure." He says, "Because I just sent Jack Davis to Shea Stadium to cover the Mets." He goes, "How about if I send you to Harlem?" So he sent this 21-year-old scrawny, geeky, nerdy Crumb, who's like never been to New York City, sent him to Harlem. And of course, all the gags were, "What are you doing up here, white boy? I'm going to kill you." But anyhow, nobody really quite did try doing something like that again until in the late 90s. Remember that? It keeps coming and going. There's a magazine called Details. It's a male fashion magazine. And it sounds like a lot of you know who Art Spiegelman is. Spiegelman's great at making money for doing very little. And he's a fast talker, as they say. So he convinced the editors at Reason to let him be an associate editor. And so in every issue, he'll pick a cartoonist and find some place to send them. And Details would pay this one cartoonist to go somewhere, and they would, in comic strip form, in a four-page comic strip form, they would do what a reporter would do. They'd write about it, but also draw it and do it in a comic strip format. And he sent me to a place I'd been to before, so I was already familiar with the term. He sent me to this comedy festival. HBO has a comedy festival in Aspen, Colorado. And I'd been there before, so he sent me there again. And I did a four-page comic about that. And to his credit, Spiegelman did a lot to help me to shape it, you know, together we kind of came up with the format, and I was pretty happy with the results. And I think that's what made you saw that piece. I reprinted it in a hate publication.
Was that, and then also a couple of the suck pieces. Covered Alan Keyes.
But the stuff I did for Suck was illustrated text. It was all text, and the illustrations had some word balloons in it, but it was mostly text. And then when I started working for Reason, I was doing those one-pagers, but it was very much, the template was the thing I did for Details, which was, I'd love to say it was your idea, but it was also
I wish, idea. I'll say it was finished out of the room. Let's take two more questions, and then we'll eat and drink some more. Yes, Stacy.
It's a two-part.
No, it's got to be two-part.
Okay, you talk about being a bad student.
Yeah.
No adult ever encouraged you to be a cartoonist.
Right.
Does that affect your deep and fiery loathing of the public education bureaucracy?
Well, no. What affected that was the fact that my daughter is a senior in a public school. It's like when you're in it, when you're a kid, you don't quite know what are you going to compare it to. But my daughter goes to an inner city school, and in order to keep like especially not affluent but at least involved parents, intact families and parents who are very vulnerable and want the kids to get a good education, in order to keep them from moving out of school or going to a private school, which is, of course, in the inner cities, what's always happening. At the time that our daughter started, when she was going to start kindergarten, they had, I'm sure you've heard a lot of this, they have alternative programs, which tend to run very hippie. They tend to be very left-wing and very hippie, and it's the first 5 years of my daughter's education. American history revolved completely around the Native Americans. Like, she still doesn't know who George Washington was, other than he's the guy on the quarter. But the thing that was good about it was the parents were allowed to be very involved, and the teachers were more motivated than in your standard public school. You know, and it was by choice, you know. And the other thing that's so ironic about it is that it's all these very liberal people who all rush to these alternative schools so they can be involved, and they're obsessed with diversity. They talked about diversity all the time, but these schools were all white. They were like, it was weird, like it was people who want so much to segregate, they want everything to segregate, but then when they pick the school that they want their kids to go to, or not all white, 95%. All the schools, while my daughter was going through an alternative program, it was all white. When my daughter's out of school, I want to wait for her to be like, so she, I keep worrying that she's going to catch some flack, but one of these days, for a reason, I'm just going to really tear the, at least the Seattle public school system apart, and all these liberal parents that talked about diversity constantly, and I'd always want to say, what are you doing in Seattle? You know, why you chose to live in the north end of Seattle, the whitest place in the country, and you just rail on diversity. It's all you talk about. It's like, who are you talking to? And you're just yelling at a bunch of other white people. It was insane. But she did, because of her very motivated teachers. It was good, and it was better. Again, because of the politics, I had problems with the agenda, but she was getting a better education than she would have in the regular public schools. One thing that started to completely screw that up when she was... Well, with when Bush got elected, was No Child Left Behind, and also everybody had to teach the tests, and that was terrible, and it completely just, it really screwed up this alternative program. It made it impossible. They couldn't do what they were trying to do. My daughter also, and because by that time, my daughter actually, she told us when she got out of high school, when she was about to start high school, she says, I'm sick with no more alternative. I don't want to do anything alternative anymore. I want to be normal. So we send her to a regular school, and again, it's still tough. She's got a decent education, but we have to be so proactive. Maybe that's true even if you're in a great school district and you're in a private school, but it's always us, like, I mean, some of the teachers, it's unbelievable, these teachers that she has, who don't even pretend to teach. They're not even pretending to teach. She had her ninth grade math teacher was just showing Hellboy, you know, and just would hand her packets. And you just hand out packets. It was, here's your lesson, and like, teach yourselves. And so my daughter would come home and she'd do all these homework, all these assignments, hand it back in, and then he'd write A+ on it. And then we get it back, and we go, wow, great. And I was like, look, I got an A+. This is when she was ninth grade and looking at it, and I don't know math, but my wife does. And she's like, Hannah, you got half of these wrong. Why did you write A+ on it? So we asked him, and he said, well, I gave her an A+ because she was the only kid that handed it in. So, yeah, it's insane. It's totally insane. So when she's out of school, I'm going to really trash them. It's nuts.
Paul Cantor, who's a professor from someplace or other, he did a great
commentary. University of Virginia.
Thank you, sir. He did a great commentary on how commerce drives art. So how did that happen for you? And also, how do you feel about the fact that comic book art is reaching a wider audience?
Well, comic books themselves aren't reaching a wider audience, but everybody now, especially Hollywood, realizes, the entertainment industry realizes that it's a great source of ideas. Especially since first there was the explosion of independent comic book publishers, but that loosened up Marvel and DC to allow their artists more creative freedom. Like starting with the first artist where they let the writers go a little bit nuts was in mainstream was with Alan Moore, who's this English writer, and Frank Miller, who's an artist and a writer. They let them go nuts, and not only did it explode, but, you know, like, God, those guys have made so many movies since then. They're like institutions in and of themselves. And Neil Gaiman as well, who I'm not a fan of, but, you know, the same with him. So it's just, what really, the reason you hear so much about comics these days is now that it's very much, everybody looks at that as the
scene. You know, you mentioned, and when you say comics aren't reaching a wider audience, in the 1940s, Superman would sell 2 million copies an issue. Now it sells maybe 80,000, something like that.
And that's as good as it gets.
Yeah. But there's no question that graphic novels and that comic books are held in a higher regard than they were certainly 25 years ago.
Yeah, and sadly...
And it's partly Spiegelman won a Pulitzer Prize or a National Book Award for Mouse.
Which is, that's a really double-edged sword, too, because, yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of, like, in the alternative indie world, it's like teaching to the test or playing to the crowd. I see a lot of guys who are doing comics, and as soon as I read the first page, I'm like, this guy's going for an award. He's going for, you know, his Peabody Pulitzer. Well, I mean, the comic book industry has its own bunch of awards.
And now everybody's like playing, you know, playing to the crowd in that way. It's like, you know, I might not have any money, but this is going to get an award, and the award will lead to a teaching gig somewhere, you know. So, yeah, they're getting very academic. Yeah, and it's very, it's pretentious. It's really, me and my friend call it the falling leaf syndrome, where to show how sensitive the artist is, it always opens up where first you see a leaf falling. And then there's a lot of leaves. And then all of a sudden you get to the third page, and then there's the foot. You see, that's a close-up of somebody's foot, and then the camera pulls back again as you're turning. And then you finally you see the whole character, and it's the stand-in for the author, and he's looking really sad as he's walking for the fallen leaves because his girlfriend dumped him. Or yelled at him, you know. And there's so many comic books that start that way, and they always win an award. If you open up with fallen leaves, you're guaranteed to win an award. And, but yeah, it's very much like if you go to the San Diego Comic Convention, which now is just, it's out of control, it's just huge. It not only was it sold out, they're scalping tickets to get into this thing. Just so you can be squashed and you go in and see nothing other than other fat fans.
Well, what do you think explains that, not the obesity of the fans? Food prices for industrial production. But,
right.
Why are comics generating that kind of intensity?
Well, that's just it. Nobody's, or not, one, generously, one out of every 10 person there cares about the comic books. But it's all the hype, it's all the movies. Like, not only do they keep making movies based on comic books, but they are the most popular movies. You know, like the Spider-Man movies. After I did that Spider-Man comic, then the plan was I was going to do that every single time another Marvel comic was going to come out. They were going to do that again. I mean, they made money off of it. It was $50,000. That's great. They made plenty of money off of it, and they were like, "What the heck?" And everybody there that worked at Marvel loved it, but. So the next movie that came out was the Hulk movie, and I did a whole comic. I did the whole thing. It's all finished. I got paid in full, but they won't release it. Because now all of a sudden it doesn't jive. My portrayal of the Hulk doesn't jive with how they want to market the Hulk, and it's protecting the brand.
So you have the Hulk walking, stepping on leaves?
What I did was I had... The gist of the story was one day they might. They keep saying they might release it, but the gist of it was... You know, like with the Hulk, it's Jekyll and Hyde. And Bruce Banner are constantly trying to figure out how do I control the Hulk, and the Hulk wants to stay the Hulk, and he wants to stay Bruce Banner. So it's like, and it was all like through modern science that he had this exaggerated split personality. So I had both the Hulk and Bruce Banner using modern science in the form of Prozac and Viagra and all these things, trying to control everything. Like not only trying to control themselves, but trying to control the other. And they wind up both having girlfriends. It's the same person, but they each have their own girlfriends, you know. So and the girlfriends are the ones saying, you know, you need Viagra, no, you need Prozac, no, you need, you know, you need a sedative, and so they're both getting, it's the same person, but they're both getting pumped full of all these drugs. But then, like, all of a sudden, right as I was finishing the comic, well, unfortunately, new people bought Marvel. They bought the Marvel company. They spent way too much money on it. And yeah, they were brand obsessed. All they cared about was the underoos. And all of a sudden, they see this comic that's almost done. And I couldn't even use... All of a sudden, they said I couldn't use the word drug. And I'm like, well, I'm writing about Prozac. And I was like, you can't see Prozac either. So we're like, we've got this story like all fleshed out. How are we going to, you know... Even we're not talking about illegal drugs. We're talking about legal drugs. You know, prescription drugs. But you still... They were so afraid of having a Hulk comic, which is for kids, which it is. The new owners, everything is always for kids. Got to protect the kids. And, you know, even though we give our kids drugs, you can't say drugs. You know, it was insane. So, but again, this is part of why... Lots of times I actually, when I work for, it's great that I have my own comic book where I can do whatever I want, but when I work for a mainstream publisher, lots of times I think it's hilarious when they ask me to bend and not say this and not say that, because what you come up with, sometimes it's even better. So as we were like, what can we say that's not drugs? So we came, it's like right out of movies from the 30s, we decided to call it serum. I'm going to take this serum that will make me erect. You know? And all of a sudden,
was so much funnier. I'm like, at first we're like, me and my editor, they're like, they're ruining the comic. But then we stick the word serum in there, we're just like, that's so hilarious.
Well, let's, let's end the formal program where everybody please hang out. We have
serum.
The bar is open, the cheese, which is kind of a solid serum, is so please talk to Peter Moore, and please give me a big please stick around and let's chat some more.
There's another comic that had beautiful art that written in the 40s and 50s.
No, but that's the name of it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the weakest shirts have been on the bottom. I can even hurry. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Or,
and you have a federal law.